Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a higher performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris.
Welcome, everybody, to State of Readiness, a fireside chat between me, Joseph Paris, your host, and an industry leader with whom I've come across my travels. So to our guest today is Ty Muse, the president and CEO of Visions Federal Credit Union, a $4.2 billion financial institution headquartered in Endwell, New York. If anybody doesn't know where Endwell, New York is, it's an hour south of Syracuse, New York, and an hour north of Scranton, Pennsylvania. Serving 200,000 members primarily in three states, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. Prior to joining Visions Federal Credit Union in May of 2013, Ty was the CFO of Hudson Valley Federal Credit Union based in Poughkeepsie, New York. Though Ty's roots are southern, he was raised in Wallkill, New York, which is Catskill Mountain region. He attended Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts on a track scholarship where he attained his undergraduate degree, a Master's of Accounting, and his MBA. Ty has over 25 years in the financial services industry, working with such prestigious institutions as PricewaterhouseCoopers, Goldman Sachs, controller at Archon Group Real Estate Division, and GE Asset Management. He's also a certified public accountant. Welcome, Ty.
Hey, thank you, JP. I appreciate this time.
Yeah, my pleasure, really. I don't know if you know this, and certainly the audience doesn't know this, but I have a long history with Visions Credit Union. It used to be called IBM Federal Credit Union. And I was a member when I was a little kid. I even know my man number still. Okay. Which ended in 02-02 because it was a suffix of my father's man number. So I actually know his man number. And, the simple fact that it's such a reasonably low number tells you how long my father's been with IBM. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So, what brought you to the financial industry in the first place? I mean, when you were a little kid, did you say, geez, I want to be the president of a credit union?
Nowhere even close. You know, it is one of those funny stories that is really the people in your life sometimes kind of direct you in a direction, even though you didn't realize you were going that way anyway. You know, you can't make this up, but when I was a kid, my goal was when I graduated was eventually open my own little grocery store or what we call them downstate New York as bodegas. I had a little bit of entrepreneurial spirit and I liked the ability to own my own little company and grow it. And, often, you know, teachers in my lives have come across and said, you know, I think you need to think bigger. And to me, bigger was just a bigger grocery store. I didn't realize they, you know, had all these other kind of leadership skills that they kept identifying from whether being the captain of the basketball team or captain of this club or, the fact that I had influence of people around me. And then I just had a business ethics teacher who sat me down in college and said, you know, I think you have the ability to do something and be something bigger, and bigger being some type of financial level within business. I went the accounting route just because I wanted to know the books well enough that I could run my, you know, for my little grocery store, I would know what's going on. So when we kind of started sitting down and my business ethics teacher, Philip Crotty, actually said, you know, I think if you sit down and he literally circled the three companies I want you to work for. And at the time it was, you know, Pricewaterhouse or Coopers and Lybrand, and they want that merging. And in Boston area, that's where I was going to school. He wanted me to work at GE because their management system was just so well and such a good program. And then Goldman, because he just thought that Goldman was really just the leader in the industry when it came to financial investing. And he just believed that it would give me the resume I needed to be anything I wanted in life. And as I kind of continued to progress, I just had this kind of directional pull towards being a CFO. Never with the CEO in mind until one day Visions Federal Credit Union reached out to me and talked to me about taking the next step.
So I think it's, if you watch Shark Tank, I mean, I'm sure that pretty much everybody watches Shark Tank, but I think it's Mr. Wonderful that is always emphasizing knowing the numbers. You got to know the numbers.
Yeah.
And I believe that wholeheartedly. But, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs who are great, you know, call it innovators, but their number skills aren't that great. You know what I mean? And I think that they reach a point of peril, you know, where, you know, they want to grow their business, but they're really mad scientists, but they don't want to relinquish control. You know what I mean? They don't want to relinquish control to the guy that's going to make or the gal that's going to make the numbers work. You know, have you ever come across any of those situations?
Yeah, I think you do. Even on some of the other things I've kind of dabbled in, whether it be helping other companies or friends with companies, you know, there's something special about that entrepreneur gene, right? You got to be willing to take risks. You got to be willing to go out there and go for it. You have this kind of mission and idea, and then all of a sudden, you start sitting down and thinking about the financial viability of it. And that's where sometimes that they lack, or they're not supported well enough. And usually what they get to is a point where they kind of outgrow their ability to keep up with it, right? So, I've worked with a couple institutions where, you know, great idea. It starts off good. Momentum's good. But once it hits that next level, it's almost like leadership needs to change, or they have to, really start beefing up their financial support system to help them put themselves in a position to basically be able to purchase and buy and grow the way they need to grow. But yeah, it's one of the cool things about when you're in commercial banking on one side of the business that we do, we often help people with their dreams and we're often that bridge that kind of helps them when they hit that next phase. You know, maybe you're the, you know, you being local, you kind of know, whether you're that pizza place who has that great sauce that finally everyone's interested in buying, and now you're trying to produce the sauce and sell it nationwide, which we do with our Speedies here, which we're known for in Binghamton. Well, that next phase is hard. It's no longer just making enough sauce so you can make it in the shop. You now have to think about how are you going to get inventory? How are you going to get a building or a warehouse and all these other steps that come along with it? And are you still profitable after doing all that?
Yeah, that's a, you know, you made a leap from other industry to pure finance, you know, basically a financial institution. And I'm going to ask you two questions that are related. The first question is, why a credit union? Okay. Mm-hmm. And the second question would be, you know, for our audience that might not know the difference between a credit union and a bank, what is the difference?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So as you can imagine, I'm going through all these great large financial institutions. And, you know, you're kind of just moving up just like you're supposed to. You know, you're moving up further and further up the line. You can see your career. And then one day you just realize that, you know, I love the finance part, but I wanted to help people. And I wasn't getting that sense, you know, as much that I always felt like I was in it for the company and help the company make money. But, you know, I felt something lacking about helping, the consumer or the partner, as much as I wanted to. And so I wound up getting my first car loan, with a credit union, and I started listening to their model. So their model was like all the good things I liked about banking, you know, having the financial support and the business acumen and all the tools and resources. But then you add in kind of this other driving mission and it, you know, this underlying thought of people helping people. You know, that the member comes first or in the regular business world, we would say the customer comes first, but really meaning it, you know, and that was kind of the drive that, I started saying, you know, that would be a great opportunity. And I got a call from the CEO of another large credit union who kind of introduced me and had me come into the company. And then, you know, the next phase was, all right, you're sitting there and you're making all these business decisions. And on some level, it was easier when I was in the financial world. You know, the only goal was profit. And now I'm sitting here in a credit union thinking like, well, geez, how do I get rid of this fee so the member doesn't have to pay it and we can make less money? Can we make even less money and still be strong? And that was just a total unique thought. So going back to banking versus credit unions, you know, they both serve a very important need. And I'm probably unlike most credit union people. I don't really talk about banking as though it's bad. I think it's a very important thing, at least in my community. We don't have enough capital in my community to lend to everyone that needs to be lended to. And the community banks do an amazing job locally. But there is a difference for those who really think, well, you know, credit unions aren't taxed. And yet they sound like a, you know, a duck, they quack like a duck, but I can guarantee you there's never a time in a bank where you sit there and go, what fees can we get rid of? You know, I can say that the genuine difference is being that not-for-profit, being focused on serving and helping your members reach their dreams and their goals and sharing in that. I think that being the core, that our goal and our need is to serve our members, and that is our ultimate owner, versus when you're in banking, your ultimate owner is a shareholder. And so they have responsibility to increase share value. And the only way you increase share value is by growing the income stream of your organization. And so that's just the challenge. You know, that's the number one difference, is what's the driving force behind how we do business. And to me, that's a big difference. You know, it's a really big difference.
So it sounds to me like the relationships, are a little bit more intimate.
Yes.
I
think you would see that if you walk into a credit union. But you know, to be fair to the small banking group, I would say that, you know, you can't do any of this banking world anymore without providing great service. But I do think it is the intimacy, but it's along with the intimacy is just that the membership knows that we're here to work for you. So when you walk into the place, you feel like you own the building, right? You feel like you own the business. And the more you contribute it and support it by giving us more loans, more deposits, the more successful we'll be, the cheaper our loans will be, the less fees we'll have, and the higher dividends we can pay. So from that perspective, I just feel like that's also a difference, that not only does the consumer slash customer or member in our case have ownership of us, that they feel that they're a direct contributor and they feel that we're there fighting for their needs.
Yeah. I remember when I first, and of course, you know, you weren't there at the beginning, when it was IBM, Federal Credit Union, but it was mostly, you know, only for IBM employees. And it was mostly just, you know, savings and checking. And then they expanded into auto loans. And then, you know, I remember my parents, in fact, getting mortgages that weren't from IBM Federal Credit Union. They were, you know, from other banks. So they weren't in even the mortgage business.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a transformation, that took place, where, you know, IBM Federal Credit Union became Visions, and, it's, the mission mandate of Visions, was transformed. Now, you weren't there for that transformation, but, you know, certainly Visions doesn't serve just IBM anymore. You know, what is the vision of Visions?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of it was kind of need-based, right? So all these credit unions were really formed out of serving the need of a specific seg or a specific company. So in this case, our particular one happened to be the birthplace of IBM here in Endicott / Inwell, New York. And, you know, our goal was to really service the members of IBM, employees of IBM that were and their families that were in either Owego or here. And over time, you know, I forgot how many thousands, you would remember better than I do, JP, on how many thousands of IBM employees that were here. Over time, that population kept shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And that's not just for IBM. That's for almost all the different SEG credit unions that were out there. So we had to have the need and ability to kind of expand and service more people as our population pool started shrinking. So we all took the opportunity, many of us, to become community charters, which allowed us to serve our communities more. So in regards to our vision, you know, for Visions, it's really just to make a difference. You know, we have a mantra here that, you know, we just want to make visions matter and matter to our community, matter to our membership. And my dad always tells me, you know, son, you can't make things matter to people. But I told him I disagree. I think you can make things matter. You just have to create a value for it. So if I gave you a piece of paper, JP, and it was just a blank piece of paper, and I said, here you go. And you would say, okay, thanks, Ty. And I'd walk away and you probably would discard it because it has no value to it. Now, however, if, you know, Mickey Mantle wound up being your favorite Yankee of all time, and I somehow gave you a piece of paper, and I had it where Mickey Mantle actually had signed that piece of paper, and I gave you that same piece of paper, you know, you would suddenly have a value to it, and you would probably cherish it and keep it. So we just have to create value, and now that piece of paper matters to you. So that's what I figured out, you know, and that's what I've been trying to push throughout our organization. If we can continue to make ourselves relevant, continue to bring value, and make ourselves matter to our membership, we'll still be part of the argument. We'll be part of the discussion. We'll be part of the value system that has them work with us. So how do you make yourself become more valuable? You got to find ways to save them money. You got to find ways to educate them and give them the best life possible. You got to find a way to give them higher dividends. You know, you got to find ways to connect them to the things that they need to be connected to in all the different phases of their lives. So for your example with your family, you know, at some point we realize, you know what, you know, we need some expertise in providing these auto loans because this is really important to the membership, and they're going to these dealers and they're not getting the best deal. The same thing with a mortgage. You know, we have the ability to offer a mortgage, and you know what, we can actually even offer it with no closing costs. We could, members expect to pay closing costs. We decided not to charge it. Why? To save them money and provide more value. And that's what's really built our name and our brand with throughout the region that we're in.
Now, you've certainly expanded your region, right?
Yes,
so, I mean, and you've gone beyond, you know, employees of IBM.
Yes.
What were some of the, obviously scaling is a motivational factor, but why did you expand the way you expanded, and where did you expand into?
Yeah,
geographically and demographically.
Exactly. And that's a real logical question. You know, so when it comes to the thought of, so think about it this way, you know, we're a cooperative. So the whole power of a cooperative is scale and size, as you kind of alluded to earlier. So, you know, and we're also not for profit. You know, no one ever goes to American Red Cross and goes, oh my goodness, you're helping more people. You're getting too big. You're helping way too many people. But for some reason in credit union land, people often think, oh, they're getting too big. And I disagree with that. With our size and our scale, we can have the ability to add other features that we wouldn't be able to do if we were a smaller credit union. So we needed that size, i.e. mobile apps and the ability to have online banking, the remote deposit so you can take a picture of your check. You can't afford to do all those things unless you're a larger institution that has some sort of scale about it. In regards to the region, that was also kind of a need base as well. You know, upstate New York is shrinking. You know, people are moving from upstate New York, or they're aging out and they're moving to Florida. Young people are moving towards the city, which is just a natural thing across the country. You know, I think, you know, you'll see across the country, everyone's moving closer to the coastline or to the cities. So we had to try to find opportunities and be opportunistic to get mergers where we could, in regions that gave us a large potential growth market to expand to. So for us, that was a merger with an institution called Paragon. They were a failing credit union. We had the opportunity to come in and help with that membership. If you look at that particular region, we've more than tripled our potential membership size, because if you're looking at Bergen and Passaic County, now you're talking about just another 1.5 million potential members that can join the credit union. And two counties, that's not even, you know, we before were three core counties with a population significantly lower. So, that's part of it as well, that, you know, you're always looking for that opportunity that will provide more potential membership, because that's really going to be the death of a credit union. It's really not, you know, there's all types of fees and other things that are brought into us, but not being able to grow and not being able to expand and share that cost and reduce that cost, that is going to be, that really would be the death of credit unions long term.
So, you know, you know, obviously you don't have a Wells Fargo ambition, you know what I mean? World domination and what have you. You know, you're very much, focused on the local. You know, so, you know, and it sounds like, you know, you have a real passion for being a good corporate citizen and a steward of your community. What are some of the things that Visions does to demonstrate that?
You know, when I started thinking about some of the things that we just rolled out even locally. So here, you know, we've stepped up to fill the void that IBM used to really fill and a lot of our large institutions used to fill with really giving and supporting a lot of the not-for-profits that are here, or the community events. You know, we just most recently rolled out a light festival. It's called Luma. That's just been growing exponentially every year. Now you say, what does that have to do with banking? It has nothing to do with banking, but it does have a lot to do with making this a vibrant community that companies want to be in and people want to live in and our employees want to live in. One of the more recent things is really just continue to expand and more than double our in-school branches. So I can guarantee you, you don't make money, you know, on a branch in a high school. But what it does do is it provides this professional job, these skill sets. It gets them talking about budgeting. It provides them deposit ability right in the school, as well as for the educators. And then we've actually even started partnering with the colleges. We're in Binghamton University. We've added a financial literacy program where we've funded. We put a 5-year plan in for funding to provide them education on this. So as you can imagine, in the high school, they've lost a lot of the talk around checkbooks and accounting and budgeting. And when you get to college, you know, you're just like, you've been so focused on getting to school. Now you've just taken out this whole substantial amount of debt. And you really don't know what to do or what's next or even how to write a resume. We offer all these things in these schools primarily just to help them, you know, and I think that's been the driving force. Around almost any decision, you know, we almost focus with that before we think about, is it a good business decision? How will this help our community? Expanding our headquarters and staying in the community that we're in, that adds to the rent roll here and a tax roll here, and it will help our community and adds more jobs here in our community. Those are all things that we kind of always think about first before we even think about, you know, how much money can we make on this product?
Yeah, I want to roll back a little bit to this financial literacy.
Yep.
This has been a personal pet peeve of mine for decades. I don't understand how high schools could graduate students that don't have a basic understanding of home economics. And I'm not talking about like, you know, how to bake, you know, a pie or something like that. I'm talking about like, you know, the finance of your home, how to balance a checkbook, you know, what is credit, how to use credit properly and how to not use credit properly. You know, just these basic, you know, fundamental building blocks that every person needs to have an understanding of as they become an adult. And I just don't understand why that's not a requirement and why that's not there's not a bigger emphasis on that.
Yeah, you know, it kind of scares me because then the parents aren't talking to their kids about it as well. And some of it because they're just not comfortable. They don't feel really good about their own finances. So we've tried to find venues and ways just to get the conversation started. One of the things I will applaud, you know, the states locally and our local politicians, at least here in Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, they have made this a priority. And they're now they're adding more requirements in schools to have some sort of program tied to that. You know, we've even partnered with a young man out of Syracuse who's just done a great job and promoted his book. And it's a book directly tied to young people on how to be successful financially and how to do budgeting and all the steps that they need, and has a checklist of things they have to do. And when they do, we'll fund their account and put their initial deposit in into a special student account for them. But you're right. I think not teaching them anything about money is like setting them up for failure.
And, yeah, I agree with that.
And so we've tried also just find ways to get the dialogue going, JP. I mean, so we filmed the video in a barbershop with Jay Williams, an ESPN announcer, former basketball player, just because kids will, like, for whatever reason, they'll listen to them more than necessarily the CEO of Vision sitting here talking. And we just tried to have a casual conversation about money and why people don't talk about money and do you know this or do you know that? And then even as late as recent as yesterday, I just did a video that we're going to post shortly, interviewing 6 different kids and just talking to them about money. And when I say kids, you know, 10 and under, and just asking them, do they know what a loan is? You know, if they buy a car, how much do you think that'll be? And is it important to save? And do you give? And what would you give to if you had money? And, you know, just the basics and just getting that conversation going. And why do we do this? We're hoping that if parents watch it, they can show it to their kids and it might lead to a conversation with their children about money, you know, maybe the mistakes they made about money or, you know, as I sit here and think about kids making a decision, you know, when I first joined the credit union, we used to be able to do up to $70,000 in student loan debt. And I made a decision and went to our board and said, you know, I'd like to cut that in half. And at first, you know, it definitely received some pushback. But then when I explained my reason, I want to help these kids make a financial decision. You know, we're fortunate enough to have a pretty amazing state universities here, and you could leave with an average debt balance of $22,000 to $30,000. By not kind of just totally just putting them in a hole and just allowing us to get more debt and loan. We could obviously make more money on it. But if you're walking out with already like financing a house before you even get out of school, you're just going to be in a tough situation, you know, and it's going to take you over a decade to get out of that situation. And I just don't think that's prudent or right. And I don't think we should facilitate it.
So, you made the, leap to being a CEO.
Yeah.
What was that all about? How'd that go?
You know, it's funny. You know, sometimes you start asking yourself when you find yourself saying, you know, if I was running the company, I would do this. If I was running the company, you know, you do that enough times. Yeah. That's probably a sign that you probably should, go run an organization. I would say, you know, being a finance guy, I think my top goal had always been to be a CFO. That was always kind of the end game once I figured out what I wanted to be when I grew up, right? But over time, you just start dabbling in these other parts of the business and you start seeing the impact you can have and the member experience. And I was fortunate enough that my previous CEO had me go run marketing in our last company is kind of like a job switch for about a year and a half. And when I started running marketing, the best thing happened there is I started remembering why we're doing this. You know, everything we're doing is for the members. You know, when you're a CFO, sometimes you just sit there and you start thinking about the profitability, you know, and how we can afford this or how do we not afford that. You look at things as expenses versus necessarily an investment into your membership. But when you start getting on the other side and you start thinking about the impact and you start thinking about the culture that you want to build and those become kind of these relentless type of feelings that you want to do and change into your organization, having the opportunity to go out there and build it yourself, starts to look really, really good to you. And, you know, I wasn't a great company, but the thought of coming to upstate New York and looking at all the assets and potential that this organization had, it started becoming really, really appealing to me and starting to change the culture here. You know, the previous culture, by my predecessor was built, in a way that worked, right? You know, it worked in the '80s and nineties and, but as we started to grow and expand and get into these other footprints and the competition's way more fierce, and now, you know, getting employment and getting people to work for you became tougher. You know, these are real challenges that we had to start figuring out and starting to adapt our culture to fit those things that were really true to us and true to what we needed to be great. That's where the focus became and that's where the obsession almost came of how to get there. And I can tell you, culture's hard, man. You know,
yeah.
I came in thinking, yeah, you know, I could change the world in 3 years, but you know, I've always been told it takes about 7 years to change culture. And I'm on my sixth of my seventh year and we're almost there. And I think it's pretty spot on. I just think it's pretty spot on.
You know, when you came from, you know, Hudson Valley and, you know, Hudson Valley had a corporate culture. Every corporation has a corporate culture, yeah. You know, and, as you're coming up through the ranks in one company, you're starting to adapt, their corporate culture. And if you don't agree with their values or their culture, you leave, you know, right. That's what happens.
Right.
You know, or you leave for a better opportunity, which is the case here. But I'm sure that when you came into Visions, you're used to a previous corporate culture. Now you have the Visions corporate culture that existed at the time. And, you know, it's really, really hard to change the hearts and minds of people. I'm going to share with you a story. I've been working my entire life. Okay. When I say my entire life, there's a funny story. When I was a kid, I was getting 50 cents a week allowance and I wanted a raise to 75 cents. When my father being a manager at IBM, he says, okay, write me a paper on why you think you deserve 75 cents. So I wrote a paper about, you know, the cost of this and the cost of that. And I can't make ends meet and blah, blah, blah. You know, kid is 70, can't make ends meet. Right. But, and we reviewed this document together and he says, I'm going to deny, your raise. And I said, why? He says, because you wrote why you needed it, not why you deserved it.
I like that.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, well, I didn't like it at the time. It really pissed me off. So I got off the bus the next day. I'm 13 years old. I got off the bus the next day. I go to Nanticoke Gardens on Route 26 there in West Corners. And, I go up to old man Ferguson and I say, listen, I want a job. And he says, well, what can you do? And I said, whatever you ask me to do. So the next thing I know, I'm making $1.85 an hour. That's a minimum wage for farmhand at the time. And, my brother was doing the lawn. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. You know, you work hard, you earn more, you know, make more, earn more.
Right.
And then I was a newspaper, carrier, the following year. And this is the culture part. There was this dog that wanted to eat me. Okay. It wanted to eat me. And when I say eat me, it wouldn't like, you know, bark and howl and, you know, and charge after me. No, it would sneak up on me. It would stalk me until it was within striking distance. And then it would, you know, come out, you know, the teeth shining. So I didn't understand this because I never did anything to dogs and I kind of like dogs, but I was collecting from this house. And the dog was on the other side of the door. And I remember this distinctly because this is where I really got into touch with, you know, empathy and understanding people's origins and, you know, they behave because of something that happened in their past. And this dog wanted to eat me. All right. And so, you know, on the other side of the door, and the owner, took the newspaper that I was delivering, rolled it up and hit the dog with it and told it to shut up. So now I understood. This dog couldn't, you know, bite the owner, right?
Right.
His master. But he could go after the person who delivers the instrument of his torture.
Exactly.
The newspaper. Okay. And I was that person. But it was crystal clear then. And I never delivered the paper to that person's house again. I went to, because I knew it was a foregone conclusion. So I just left it in the mailbox down the road a little bit.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, you coming into a new corporate culture that was different from, you know, the values that you held, it must have taken a long time to get people to understand or believe in or adapt the new way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and then, so not only that, once even you express it to them, then do they believe it? Like, you know, it's just the flavor of the month. So, I just worked really hard on getting my messaging very clear and concise and short, you know. So we started doing things really simple, like, you know, three rules. We started looking at all the projects that were out there. God knows we were in project purgatory, where it was just like project after project after project that was sitting out there. And some projects were 5 years old. And I'm like, we're still trying to do this project. It's probably not even a viable tool anymore. So, you know, we started getting things really simple where we pretty much said, you know, if you're not working on these three things, you're not working on things that are important to the company. So you need to be working on something that's either going to make the lives of our members better, lives of your employees better, or something that positively impacts the bottom line, right? So if you're just doing something as a pet project and it's not doing one of those three things and in that priority, then you're probably not working on something that we should be putting our resources and time to. The next part was just changing the sense that we used to be a very top-down decision-making organization. But as we started expanding, you know, you can't wait for just the CEO to make every decision in the organization, right? It just does not make sense. You know, you have to empower people, and you have to kind of give them the guardrails to work within. And then you have to sit down with them. And sometimes you have to go over a decision. Like, you know, there's times that I may want to go one way. My VP might want to go another way. I might feel mine is a little bit better, but I always take that VP's path because I think they're going to own it more and they're going to drive for the success more. So we had to go from a place where all the decisions were really made by the CEO, which you could do when we were just a one county area, right? Two county area, but you couldn't really do as we started looking where our growth markets were, you know, a few hours away. And there's a whole new group of people that were merging in who had their own culture on top of that. So we had to start working on, making that a priority. And then, like I said, make visions matter mantra, you know, just getting everyone behind the fact that, you know, we're going to try to make visions matter by helping our members and by focusing in on that. The next thing we started realizing is, you know, I'm sitting here saying I want all these people to be leaders. And I started thinking about it. Well, we've never trained them to be a leader, right? You usually get promoted because you're really good at a job. So what happens? You get promoted. but that's a different skill set when you have to manage the people to do the job than the person who does the job.
Yeah.
So we actually had to build a whole leadership program, and it's great that you're going to be part of that as well. You know, where we had to sit down and say, you know, what are the real 6 to 10 top things we need from our leaders? And let's educate them on it. You know, I'm the first session really to set the tone where, you know, I call the first session is called leadership, not lip service. You know, everyone says they want to be a leader. Yeah, you walk around the room, everyone wants to be a boss. But like, what type of boss do you want to be? Like, you know, and how are you going to deal with adversity and conflict and confrontation? But also, how are you going to motivate your staff and engage your staff? And I talk about all my experiences across the organizations I worked at. And then I talk a little bit about, you know, Jack Welch, who's definitely one of my idols. And in my time at GE, I found a lot of things that he did. And the way he trained us and the programs he provided us gave us a lot of the tools to be successful no matter where we went. But I also talked to him about the things that I felt that, you know, it's not necessarily lip service, but it's, you know, Jack always says, you know, one of the things you got to be doing is, you know, is winning. And he talks about winning, and winning's fun. Well, you know, or he says, you know, you need to be a chief fun officer. That's a Jack Welch line, be a chief fun officer. And Jack, winning's fun. Well, I can tell you when I would see my number ring and if I had, you know, a call from headquarters, it wasn't like I felt fun in my stomach. So where's the disconnect? Well, the fun was what was fun to Jack. It wasn't necessarily what was fun for me, Joe Smo employee, you know, 10 levels down. So it's just trying to tie the winning in and making sure they understand how everything they do helps us win and their participation in winning. And that is something that I learned from Jack. Like, he would also say, you know, well, we're going to do this. This has no benefit to you, but this has the benefit to the organization. I always really respected that, you know, instead of trying to like say, oh, this is great for you. And it's not, you know, he was already super clear. Like, this is great. You know, we're going to do this at GE Capital. This is going to be really good for capital. It's going to maybe hurt treasury internally because these services were here, but you know, then we can sell these products to other people and we'll do better. I appreciated that. And I think that's a huge part of always making sure that you make your messaging go down to the micro level, making sure that the person that's hearing it understands it. And then communication. You know, I can tell you communication is the number one problem in every organization, even if you're a sole proprietor. You don't talk to yourself enough. I mean, I'm amazed at how I can say one thing and by time I hear it from an employee, it'll be something completely different than what I said. So we had to learn how to use other mediums to communicate. So you have to communicate, you know, where they can hear you. You have to communicate where they can read it. You have to communicate in video format. You have to communicate. You can't over communicate anything that's important.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. So we're going to take a break here, Ty, and come back after a few moments and continue on with some of your personal perspectives. We talked about visions and your journey to visions, but I want to get to know you a little bit more. I think the audience would also. So this is Joe Paris. I have Ty Muse, and we'll be back in a moment.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Operational Excellence Society, a think tank, a creator and aggregator of knowledge and know-how, serving businesses and professionals who wish to learn more on the various topics which combined comprise the discipline of operational excellence. Learn more at www.opexsociety.org.
Welcome back. This is Joseph Paris, State of Readiness, a fireside chat, and our guest today is Ty Muse, CEO of Visions Federal Credit Union. Ty, we've talked about visions and the journey of visions and your experience on onboarding as a CEO, but you know, what's your personal motto or mission statement?
That's just a great question. I think it's funny when people don't have them, you know. My father has this line, and you often hear, like, it's funny, as you get older, you start appreciating more things your father told you or your mother told you. And, you know, my dad would always say, son, you know, you'd be crazy to walk in without a plan for anything. He goes, like, it'd be insane to walk in if you had to fight Muhammad Ali, because that was our childhood idol, you know, walk in to fight Muhammad Ali without a plan. And he goes, actually, it's a plan. It's a good plan on how to get knocked out, right? And so it kind of resonated with me. And he said, you know, even your own life, like, how do you not have a plan or some type of, you know, like, true north, so you can make sure when you're in these kind of tough decisions, you're making sure you're doing the right decision for yourself and your family. And so one of the things I started thinking about and about as I had these big jobs and I'm moving up in each of these large companies, but I didn't feel fulfilled. I started thinking about, well, why? You know, this is like everything I wanted as a kid. I wanted to be, you know, in this elite position, in this elite organization. But I found something was missing. So I started thinking about writing down, like, what's really important to me. And I noticed a theme, and the theme was always helping people, you know, and helping people reach the best version of themselves. So, you know, my mission statement, and I share it with every employee here, personal mission statement, is that everyone that I come into touch with, that I hopefully help them reach the best version of themselves in their life. And that's just being a conduit, right? That's full service leadership, right? That's really coming in saying that it's not about me, it's really about you. And I get selfish enjoyment out of helping you reach the best version of yourself. So it isn't totally selfless act, but it is something that has made me happier in my life that, you know, when I'm helping, whether I'm investing in a company or organization, that sometimes I'm investing in the people. The whole product that we might roll out might fail, but I can see their growth and I can see the next product, how much better they're going to be at it. When I meet my staff, I really try to connect with every member and every employee. And I think you could literally walk into any branch, and we have over 51, and you could say, hey, you know, I know Ty. And I think almost to a person, they would say, oh, really? We love Ty. And that doesn't happen accidentally. That happens intentionally, you know, that you're really sitting down and making that connection with every employee. Now, that's going to be harder and harder to do as we grow. So you have to become more creative of making that connection with each employee. But I think that's a real simplistic way that I live life. But it's also helped me at 48 years old be the happiest I've ever been.
Well, I mean, I've met you several times, and you are always so positive and full of energy. And it really is, it's always a pleasure just sitting down with you. And, you know, the conversations, you know, if we didn't have hard stops sometimes, our conversations, I'm convinced, would just keep on going. But the thing is, you know, the one thing I get from you all the time is that you do care.
Yes.
And you absolutely enjoy helping people, and that caring and that helping, that giving actually comes back to you, you know, like tenfold.
Yeah.
Because the more you help people, I could see it, that the more you get energized.
Absolutely.
And it really is awesome to see it, because I look around and the opportunities to help are all around us.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? All we have to do is have our eyes open.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? We just have to look for that opportunity. It's there all the time. And I think that just so often, for whatever reason, people aren't looking and people aren't having a sense of imagination.
I like that sense of imagination. You know, when it goes to helping, it first started for me when I started thinking about networking. And as a young person, when you're first taught to network, right, you're supposed to go out there and meet 10 people. And you share names, and when you're networking, you're sitting there thinking about what you can get out of each of these people. And it just seemed backwards to me. So I started going to these events and trying to meet less people, but trying to figure out how I can help each of the people that I met. And my network is, you know, 20-fold what it would have been doing the other strategy. So it started with, you know, even something as simple as networking, when you make it about yourself, you're not going to do well. When you make it about them, you're going to do great.
Absolutely.
And my own philosophy in life that, you know, every time you help someone, you're helping yourself. And if you really believe that, it becomes easier. It doesn't become a labor. It becomes a love.
Right. But, it takes a leap of faith, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to just believe that if you're a good person, good things are going to happen to you.
Absolutely.
You know, that's all there is to it. And you can't be transactional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can't expect a quid pro quo. You have to say, you know what? That payback is going to come in its own time.
Absolutely.
You know, it was funny. I'll give you a story. I had to go take a train from Frankfurt to Warsaw for a variety of reasons instead of flying. But I'm standing at the train station and I hear this thump, thump, thump coming from the stairwell. What the heck is that? So I go over there and it's just this ancient woman dragging a suitcase up the stairs, and it's going thump, thump, thump. Okay. So of course I go down and I help her with the suitcase and I just carry the suitcase up to the platform, and she comes up and she wants to give me a bottle of water for my effort. And of course I don't speak German. She doesn't speak English, but you know, I don't want the water, but thank you very much. I just, you know, and the train comes, we're getting on the same train. So of course I help her on the train, help her bag on the train, and I don't see her for the next, you know, several hours while we're taking the train to Berlin. And I'm seeing that the train is late, and I got like maybe 10 minutes to catch my Warsaw train. And poof, lo and behold, there's this woman. And I'm like, oh no. So I have to help her off the train, of course, and her bag. And wouldn't you know, there's another stairwell. There's no elevator. There's another stairwell. Okay. So I know what's happening here. So, you know, I'm looking at the watch, you know, tick tock. My train is getting tighter and tighter here. And, you know, I'm helping her down the steps with her bag, and I carry the bag down the steps, and she is so old that she's actually holding on to the railing and walking down backwards, like rappelling down. Okay. Cause she can't walk facing down the stairs. She's got to face backwards and rappel down using the railing. And I'm like, oh my God. So she finally gets to the bottom of the stairway, and she now wants to give me some money. So, you know, she had some euros out, you know, like some paper euros, like maybe it was a 10 or a 20 or whatever it was. It's like, I don't want your money. You know what I mean? It's like, no. So I'm refusing the money because I'm not interested in the money. And then she starts crying and hugging me.
Oh, wow.
And it's like nobody's ever shown her a kindness in her life. And it was just like, you know, something, this is something that happened, you know, 8 years ago, but it's etched in my brain like it was yesterday.
Wow.
But these opportunities to make a gigantic difference in somebody's life with zero effort or near zero effort
right.
is all around us.
I agree.
You know, and I think we just have to do better at keeping our eyes open and having a sense of imagination.
Yeah, I like that.
So anyway, we're going to get to the speed round here. And before we do that, I was wondering, you know, I have a proposed motto for visions. I mean, make visions matters is pretty good, but how about visions? Our only interest is in your money.
Wow. Can you imagine that? Our only interest in our money? That would go the complete opposite way there.
You know? Yeah, but it could be actually taken two ways, right? It could be actually taken two ways. Yeah. So some speed round questions here. You ready?
Yes.
Okay. So who's the one leader? I mean, you've obviously been surrounded by influencers and leaders your entire life. Mm-hmm. But who's the one leader that stands out that you look up to most, and why?
For me, it's still Jack Welch. You know, even, you know, you might have some negatives out there for certain things, but in general, his style is contagious. And even the words, you know, he makes up words, you know, to describe the organization that just gets you fired up, man. And just the way he always tied winning and being a former athlete, I think deep down there's something to that. But I think he's always just doubled down on management and people. And that's just my style. And I just dig him.
Did you say that he makes up words?
I swear he just makes up words. Like if you look, you know, I was trying to think about the one when he went to boundarylessness or whatever, you know, when he wrote it was like the third or fourth book, and he just started describing, cause there wasn't a word to contain how he felt about what he wanted his people and his organization to be. And sometimes you just gotta make it till till they adopt it, you know. I was with a guy and his name was Tim Raines. Don't know him from Adam other than he told me his name was Tim Raines. And we're out one night and we're talking to him and we're laughing. And all of a sudden the guy said, you know, I want to keep it superficial with you. You know, everyone else says, I want to keep it real with you. He said, I want to keep it superficial with you. I'll never see you guys again, but I had a great time. And he left. Whatever reason, that just resonated with me and it just stuck in my mind. So my friends and I kept using it like, oh, we're just going to keep this superficial. 2 years later, we were walking around somewhere in like Chicago or Myrtle Beach and someone said it back to us and we started laughing. So, you know, it became our own phrase that we just made like the norm, after a while, if you just say it enough. I just felt like, you know, Jack, the way he would kind of describe something, you know, wing the wing, you know, we all kind of know what wing the wing is now, but when he said it, like it was a visual, like he was literally picturing, you know, I want this experience to be, you know, from the second you thought of us to the second you don't think of us. And I just thought he had a way to describe things that made the receptionist understand, as well as the top engineer in the metal section understand.
So what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Best piece of advice. You know, everything comes from my dad, you know, and it's not that my mom didn't give me good advice. I just think she gave me so many pieces as I went along that it just kind of stuck, you know. My dad has funny ways to say things. So one day he said, you know, son, you're too big to be hiding behind a skinny tree. Now, you got to remember, from the South originally. So you're like, what the heck does that mean? So I think I was trying to conform too much. And, you know, when you're 6 foot four, black man, I think you're trying to almost trying to just fit in and not make your presence too big. And he was just trying to tell me, you know, son, you just have a big presence about you. You may as well just own it. Leverage that swagger, you know, don't let it become arrogance, you know, but people like confidence, and go out there and be the best version of you. Don't worry about what other people want you to be, but just go out there and try to be the best version of you. You know, when I was younger, he used to worry about that, but now I'm older, he always says that's my best trait now, that, I'm not so worried about that stuff. You know, I just go and do what I think is right, and what my heart believes, and it just seems to always work out to the right place. And then when I'm wrong, at least I can live with it. You know, when you're coming from where your heart tells you to go and be, and you're wrong, you know, you can live with that mistake. The worst is when you don't follow your heart and it's a mistake, and then your gut's been telling you the whole time not to do something.
Yeah. And it sounds like you're sharing that same advice with the people and your colleagues at Visions.
Absolutely. You know, we're trying to be innovative. I always think this is funny too. So if you go to any leader, every leader goes, you know, I want to be innovative. You know, I want to be innovative. And then their employee makes a mistake, and what do? They punish them.
Yeah, right.
I mean, like, innovation by nature means failure, right? like you're going to fail till you figure it out. And so, I mean, you can't keep making the same mistake. Don't get me wrong. You can't every day blow up the company. But, you know, if you want an innovative culture, you have to give them a safe place to try and play. And then you got to tell them, like, I hired you, you know, when I joined the company and I had my staff for about 2 years and I was trying to still deal with this culture thing, one day I came back in and I hired all my staff again. And it sounds so cheesy, but I just wanted them to know, you're my choice. Like, I didn't just inherit you. I chose to keep you here because I want you here and you add value. And here's a way you can help me fulfill our dream of this organization. And I want to know your dream as well. And how can we make this a better place? We had so many low-hanging fruit ideas that people just were afraid to share. And we just started going after them. And, you know, we grew rather quickly because of it, you know. And it was just empowering, you know. I was in DoubleTree in Reading, Pennsylvania. And it literally was the best experience I had. And every single employee kept saying, you know, you're in the best DoubleTree in the country. Actually, the world. We're the highest rated. I'm like, in Reading, Pennsylvania. Like, that makes no sense to me. Like, why is this? But, you know, after a while, they said it so much, I started telling people, you know, I'm in the best DoubleTree in the world. And so everybody from the greeter walked me up, the greeter walked me to my room, you know, and made sure everything was good. Then they called to make sure everything in my room was the way I liked it. Did I need anything? And then I went down to the bar, and the bartender was amazing. One of our employees, it happened to be their birthday, and he gave him a round. And so I'm asking him, you know, this whole greatest thing, like, why do you think this happened? He said one word. I go, what is that word? He said, they empower us. He goes, empower. That's the most powerful thing you can do. He said, just feeling that I have some ability to impact our success just motivates me. And I was thinking, like, if even the bartender can tell you the secret sauce of your organization, you're going to do pretty well. And we all look forward to going back to that DoubleTree I go there like at least once a quarter. And even if I'm only there for a meeting, I'm still sitting here thinking, man, I'm in the best DoubleTree in the country right now. And it's because of the way that all the employees feel about the organization. And then also the community's really adopted it. You know, if you can, he looked for people that you pretty much walk to the organization. So it would really be like community owned and run. So they just take pride in, and the hotel itself. So it's just one of those things that I just think kind of resonates with me.
So you're saying that sometimes people have a fear of doing what's right?
All the time. Yeah. Even if they know it's right, they're afraid to say it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was trying to remember where I heard this story, you know, where they're sitting in this company and the company and the guy's saying, you know, they sell dog food. I think it's probably a Jim Collins, either Great by Choice or Good to Great book. And he's sitting there and he's doing an all staff meeting. They were number one dog food for years and now their sales are down. So he fired the ad agency and then the sales went down again. So he fired his whole marketing department and then the sales went down again. So he had a big all staff meeting, had all the employees across the whole organization come in and he said, I'm looking for ideas. You know, we got to come up. This makes no sense. This, we're the best out there. And then one worker stood up and raised her hand and he's like, what's your advice? He goes, maybe we should just build better dog food. You know, and you start laughing, but it's almost that simple that there's a lot of people sitting here that have a better idea of how we can do something. And over years and years, they've been told not to raise their hand. Maybe that's the military. I mean, it works in some places, right? Like in the military, you don't have enough time. You're in the middle of a battle. You can't have be answering like 20 questions, right? But in our organization where you can plan and think ahead, you need to give them a long runway. So that they can prepare, you know, like in your book, you know, State of Readiness, you know, don't be surprised if you haven't done the exercise to make sure you're in a state of readiness. And I that's another thing that just really stuck with me as well. And why we connected was just, you were just speaking the truth about a lot of things I believed in my life and you just somehow found the ability to put it on paper and we shared it amongst all our leadership and our organization. And I think there's a reason for that. And I don't know if it's culturally, I don't know if it's organizationally, I don't know if it's even the state of America, but, I think you gotta be bold and I think you gotta put those ideas up there and it's up to leadership to make it a safe space for you to feel comfortable to do that.
Yeah. I always thought it was funny that, you just accidentally happened across my book in Barnes and Noble and you didn't even know who I was or that I was from the area, even though I lived in Germany for 8 years at the time. So,
that's pretty funny. We're reading the, you know, we're getting, reading through the book and my second in command and I are both reading and we're laughing because we see where you're from and we're like, this can't be the same place. What are the odds? and then we actually had the same friends and it was a true blessing. It was a real gift to us.
That's really funny. So, that's one of those things where you just don't know when the payback's going to be.
Right. Exactly.
You know, absolutely. So, what's a personal habit that contributes to your success? I mean, I think everybody in the audience now understands what that is, but,
it's positivity. I look at every single obligation as an opportunity, man. I don't look at it as the glass half empty or full. It's just, you know, I just am glad I still got something to drink, you know, I just genuinely feel that I'm just going to live my best life and that's a decision I'm making and I'm going to try to help everyone else do it too. And it's not as hard as people make it, you know,
it really isn't,
you know, like if you look for something, you know, I was saying this to my head of HR, we're sitting down and we're having a one-on-one and I try to, everyone who's an AVP or up, I try to make sure they can have at least 1 hour a month that they can sit with me and we could just talk about their career and what they're trying to do and what they're trying to be and where they're headed. And so, you were talking about, you know, do you ever see yourself being a CEO? And she's like, yeah, I want to be a CEO. I'm like, well, that's the easy question, but like, what type of CEO do you want to be? You know, and what type of leader do you want to be? And then we're just talking about like how you look at things. If you're always looking at things to see where they're broken, you rarely notice where they work, you know? And it's almost like an engineer perspective. You know, I have a lot of friends that are engineers and they're amazing minds. But they always are thinking about how things fail and then how they can build a safeguard against failure. Entrepreneurs are always like, you know, I'm just leaping. I hope there's a net, you know? So there's got to be somewhere in between that you got to build your culture and your organization. And I was saying that with your staff, you know, you look at what they built and you probably go, oh, this is great, but here's the things we need to fix. But do you talk about, you know, how they come to this decision to build it this way? And maybe there's a good reason they built it this way. And saying then, coming back to, well, I was almost going this way, but what do you think would be better or worse from doing that? You know, and how do you create that type of conversation?
Super. So, I don't want to, you know, catch off guard here, but this is going to be a little bit of a maybe a personal question. What one do-over? Yeah. You had one do-over in your entire life. What one do-over comes to mind?
You know, it's funny. I wish there was only one, right? But, you know, if I had to say, you know, I'm going to break it in two, though. Like, one, organizationally. I got here, man, and I just was going to light the world on fire. And we came in, and we were 3 billion. I grew to 4 point whatever billion we are today in, like, the first 2-3 years. And it was just too fast. I mean, it took 50 years to grow to 3. And I just came in and just tried to change everything. And that didn't make sense, right? You know, even though if I knew it was broken, you have to have steps to this kind of process. That you have to make sure that people can see the benefit, they can understand why we're doing the change, that they get them bought in, you get invested. And even though you can grow that fast, I think you don't want to, because I saw cracks in infrastructure. I saw some of our service levels drop, and I had to remember what was most important. What was most important wasn't to grow today. What was most important was our members. So if I took care of my members first and I did all the implementations, the things I need to make my member experience better, that growth would have happened organically anyway. I did it through merging. I did it through all aspects of any way I could grow, because getting back to scale. And that was one where I was like, okay, looking back, if I were to do it again, I would have probably more strategically worked my way to this area. I would have prioritized everything that was membership and membership referral based first. And I would have probably said maybe, I think I still would have said yes to the mergers we did, but you know, I probably would have said yes to maybe one or two more that were more strategically aligned in hindsight. Go ahead.
But you don't know, how fast you can go until you've exceeded it.
Yeah. And then the other side of it was, so what did I do when that happened? Well, then I turned off the car, and then now I'm trying to turn the car back on. It was much harder to turn back on. I probably should have left the car on and let it idle and drive slower. But instead I just kind of shut down all initiatives till we can kind of finish the initiatives we had. But I can tell you, as a leader, if you don't have them still jogging, at least jogging in place, you know, this is a reason why, if you ever watch, like, on the racetrack, you know, after an accident, they're still driving, you know, they're still taking the lap. And it still counts the overall calculation, but once it's ready to go, it's much easier to get at top speed than versus the beginning of the race where they're at a standing position. So, but you're right. You don't know how fast you can go till you test the speed. But, you know, I think some general common sense was, you know, there's a reason why it hasn't doubled this fast before, right? You know, right. And it just seemed like, in a lot of levels, it just seemed so easy. Cause I also came from an organization that was already there. I'm already at the larger size. So I was thinking, like, well, you know, this is all we need, these 10 things. So the 10 were really clear, but it came at a cost. And sitting back and reinvesting in my infrastructure, particularly in my contact center, is what really helped fix that. Reinvesting in my mobile app, even though we already had a new mobile app when I got here, doubling down right away and upgrading it immediately. Those are all the things that kind of put me in the position we are in today, where we are ready to double. But we're going to try to double slower than we initially intentionally paced. And if it happens faster, to your point, we'll take it. But we're going to make sure that we don't lose sight of why we're doubling, and it's to provide us some ability and flexibility in our balance sheet to do the things we want to do for our members.
And now you have the ability to see the warning signs, having already gone through it once.
Yeah, we absolutely. The flags are easier. Then the other part, I guess I didn't anticipate with that growth, was you need the people, right? Like, it's just hard to find great people. So either you got to build them, and then you need a longer runway to build them, or you got to find a way to attract them into your organization and bring them to New York.
So did you have a personal do-over too you wanted to share?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's funny. Again, you got to remember, my idol's like Muhammad Ali, right? So Muhammad Ali, he would tell you he was the greatest, right? And it's just a different era and a different time. And I think when I was growing up, that you almost felt like you had to be your own self-promoter. right? Because that's how Ali did it, and that's how all the greats were doing it at the time. You know, Richard Pryor's, you know, they were just these kind of bold, brash people. And when I went to PricewaterhouseCoopers, I just remember that when I got there, you know, you gotta remember, you know, 6'4", I'm athletic, I'm big humor, I kinda got that Magic Johnson smile, so you just feel usually good when you're around me. And just always understanding the difference between, you know, swagger and arrogance. And, when I first came into the world and, you know, ablaze, I would get advice. And I was thinking, ah, oh, they're just hating on me. They don't like that I'm here and I'm moving up so quickly. And, you know, I would think, or like, oh, they should already know me. I'm the only black male in the entire, office in Boston at the time. You know, I think there were two or three of us. And, you know, I was walking down the hall and this partner, his name is Bob Valletta, sees me. He's walking up towards me and I'm smiling like, oh, this guy, he actually knows who I am, you know? And, he gave me the mail because he thought I worked in the mailroom. Like, and I just remember, so again, talking about immaturity. So I was like, oh, okay. And I let him walk away and then I threw it away. That was a horrible thing to do. Like, I should have never done that. I should have, and I look at the immaturity of myself, and you know what? Statistically, he was probably right. Because the other 10 black males all worked in the mailroom, so more than likely, it was the right conclusion. But I took it personal, and I think sometimes when we're young, I think about, like, I feel like I moved up very quickly. But I think I could have done even better if I just had the ability and patience to understand, you know, not to confuse swagger. Like I learned how to make myself the end of the joke. So when I'm making fun of something that's going wrong, I usually make fun of what I'm doing wrong, right? But not understanding before, when you kind of come in like swagger, you know, that it comes across sometimes like I'm making fun of them when I'm not. So I just had to learn, like, you got to pay your dues. You got to earn it. It doesn't matter what you almost did in the past is what you're going to do in the future for them. I started doing everything in my power to help the people above me do great. And as they moved up, they pulled me with them. But I think, you know, I think I did it the hard way. The first 5 years, man, I was out there trying to lift my own self up and pull myself up by every, like a rock climber on my own. You know, this hasn't been done, you know, this has been done before. I don't have to recreate the wheel and you got to rely on those people in front of you. And the way you do that is by helping those people, become the best versions of themselves. But I could tell you, you know, the first 5 years of my career, I definitely didn't do that. I was very likable. But I definitely kind of always came in like, I have to do this on my own and have to do it my way. And maybe that's a young person mistake, but it's just, it was wasted energy and time that I look back on, like, and thinking that, you know, it all seemed to work out pretty well, but I often wonder if I would have stayed that path, you know, what could that have really cost me?
Well, you know, I think that when we're young, or even when we're not in the right mood at this, you know, we do stupid things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You called it immature, but just, you know, just I mentioned lack of imagination.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, and I'm sure that you do things similar now. I mean, maybe not as dramatic and not as stark because of the circumstances, but, you know, I'm sure on a daily basis you say, you know what? I could have done that better.
Yeah. I do. I really try to take an assessment each day. You know, what could I have done better today? Yeah. And there's always room. You know, and I'm just fortunate, you know, I think also that I'm in a place now that I realize that I'm always learning. You think right as you're a CEO, like you're done, but you actually do more. Like I read more now than ever. I evaluate myself now more. I feel like I'm learning more now than I ever was. And I think that's why it's so fun. But, you know, when you're younger, maybe you think there's like this end to it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But there isn't, you know, it's just the bar keeps moving ahead of you. And maybe the distance from the bar shrinks, but it's never in grasp.
So last question here. And, you know, what's next and why do you love the word penultimate?
You know, I'm a triple jumper, right? For those who don't know, it's like the next to last phase of anything. And as a triple jumper, it doesn't matter. You have three jumps, but I can guarantee you almost every great jumper, their next to last phase is amazing. And all the bad jumpers, their next to last phase is bad. It's almost what you do before that last thing sets you up for a great finale. So I'm kind of in that phase in my own career, right? It's like, you know, what's next? What's the penultimate, the next, the last big things that I'm trying to get done to set myself up? And as a jumper in college, you know, I actually was fortunate enough this year to run into my old college coach at a track meet this past winter. And, you know, we're talking about like Hall of Fame. My wife's inducted in our college Hall of Fame, and he always says I should have been inducted in our Hall of Fame as well. And I always said, nah, I was a good jumper. I was always number two in everything, but I was never number one. And he said, you know, you could have been number one. And I just remember this jump you took where you ran down, you took your first two phases, and then you bailed out and you never took your final phase. And 30 years later, he's like, remembers this specific jump. And I thought that was interesting. I thought, like, if it was just a great jump, I wonder if you would remember it. But there's something about when people quit, right? No mas, you know, when they don't let themselves achieve what they can achieve and they don't set themselves up so they never get to their final phase in the right manner, that just is something that I've been almost obsessed with. Like, how do you have, like, in triple jump, you in your first phase, if you go out too far in your first phase, your second phase won't be appropriate enough to keep the momentum and speed that you need to have a good last phase. If you make it too short, you're going to wind up jumping too high, and then your final phase will be too high, and you won't get the what you need out of it. Or if you make your first two too low, it won't even matter, because even if your long last phase is great, it won't be enough to accomplish the maximum result. So I think I just find that word amazing for even describing this town. Like, Binghamton is a city of loss, right? We've lost all these amazing, great companies. But then a kid like me who moves here from Newburgh, New York, who's already was in a kind of a downturn, and come here, all I see is all these great things and all these opportunities. And I always feel like, well, we're kind of in that penultimate phase, right? Like, if we do the next things well in this city, wow, the next phase is going to be amazing. And I think that's where I am with this company right now. We got a real clear understanding of what we had to do, and we spent this last year investing in that, whether that be on leadership, whether that be on infrastructure, whether that be on technology, big data, robotics, surrounding ourselves around smart people like yourself and others, and having them be part of our family and our team, or bringing them into the organization. That has really set us up for what's clearly going to be our next doubling phase over the next 8 to 10 years. And what does that mean? That means we go from, you know, 4 to 4.5 billion to 9 billion, and setting up for the next CEO so she or he could take this organization to the level that's even beyond my wildest imagination. And in my tenure of 20 years, I would be able to triple the organization. And to me, that's enough, you know, and I think my voice will be heard. And it's time for a new voice at that point. But there's a lot of fun things to do over the next 14 to 15 years still. But, you know, that's what's next. It's helping more people. It's, you know, getting us past that. You know, we served over 200,000 people today, but helping 500,000 people. All those things are really, really important to me.
That's awesome. Awesome. Well, Ty, thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure having you on the show, and I really appreciate your time and effort and everything that you've been doing for your constituents and the community at large.
Thank you again. Thank you for this forum. It's outstanding. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much. So you've been listening to State of Readiness with your host, me, Joseph Paris, and our special guest, Ty Muse, CEO of Visions Credit Union.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.